The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. Programs are also made possible in part by a grant from the Idaho Humanities Council, the state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Forum series sponsors are AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Echelon Group, Micron, and St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Sue Rentz.
Hello, and welcome to today's City Club of Boise Forum on Workforce Development. I'm Sue Rentz, and a former board member and longtime part of the forum's committee, and today's moderator. I want to welcome our radio listeners today, joining us via Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 FM and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. Today's forum is available to our audience in large part because of our City Club partners and sponsors. And I'd like to take time to thank a few of the organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations and engaged citizens. We thank especially our media partners, which include Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and Peppershock. And also very important, our university partners that include the U of I, Boise State, and Northwest Nazarene. Following our speakers' opening presentations, there will be an opportunity for them to respond to your questions. On behalf of today's forum chair, Terry Ottens, and the forum's committee, I'd like to point out that you'll probably not hear mention of two issues that have received quite a lot of recent media attention. The Farm Workplace Modernization Act, legislation that's being advanced, co-sponsored by Representative Mike Simpson of Idaho's 2nd District, is an important piece of legislation, and though it relates to employment, it's not the topic of our conversation today. The other one that we've seen a lot, especially in the newspaper, is the seasonal hiring, especially by Idaho Ski Reports. Resorts. I think that's because we're all, when the weather's getting cooler, we're all now praying for snow. Anyway, a little background as we start discussing our forum topic, workforce development in Idaho. For years, leaders in industry and the trades have recognized that a shortage of skilled laborers is on the horizon. Many of our skilled workforce are aging out of their professions. That's the nice way of saying retiring, I guess. And young people have generally not been as encouraged as we'd like them to be to view the trades as a viable, good-paying career. If this trend cannot be reversed in the near future, the economic impacts could be devastating. Idaho is fortunate and probably has been proactive in some way that our jobless rate, that is, the unemployment rate, is low. In September, while the nation's rate dropped to a 50-year low of 3.5%, Idaho's is even lower, 2.9%, and has been at that rate for three straight months. Our panelists will address, among other things, the skills gaps and the barriers to training a workforce qualified to do the jobs that don't always have a huge talent pool. And they'll hopefully address some challenges that we've seen on the national scene. In his book, Failure to Adjust, which has a subtitle of How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy, Edward Alden, a longtime reporter on trade deals and now a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, notes that while some companies like AT&T have established ambitious retraining programs to encourage their employees to retrain in math, science, and computer skills to run new systems, that not all companies have followed suit. He notes that corporate apprenticeship programs that provide on-the-job training or retraining decreased by one-third between the years of 2000 and 2015. Now I'm going to introduce our panelists who are going to shed a lot of light on the issues that I've just barely touched upon. And I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they will speak. First is Dr. Harold Neville, who was raised in the Treasure Valley on a family farm. He's a graduate of Fruitland High School and following his graduation served as state president of the FFA for a year, which delayed his starting college or the career that he chose at that time. He did go to school through the years and holds a BS in sociology from State University of New York, an MA in education from Boise State, and did further graduate work earning a PhD in education from the University of Idaho in Moscow. Harold served in the U.S. Navy, rising from seaman recruit to lieutenant commander during his 21-year career. During that time, he served on 4 submarines, 3 submarine tenders, and served as an officer in charge of Space Satellite Tracking Base. Following his retirement from the Navy, he returned to Idaho and in 1997 started a career in education. He has taught science, math, and business, among other subjects at the high school level, and worked in program management for trade and industry programs. He served as the Career and Technical Education, that's CTE for short, and sometimes we may hear our panelists talk in using the acronyms. And he was the coordinator for that for the Meridian, now the West Ada School District. In 2010, he became the CTE coordinator for the Canyon Owyhee School Service Agency. That acronym is CASA, C-O-S-S-A, and the very next year was selected to be the CEO of that organization. Harold lives south of Nampa, where he raises cattle on his 80-acre ranch, and he has 2 married children and 6 grandchildren. Our next panelist is Janie Revere, a fifth-generation Idahoan, and I would bet not many of us can claim that. She was born and raised on a ranch in Three Creek in Owyhee County. She earned a bachelor's degree in agricultural economics from Oklahoma State University and has done postgraduate work in agriculture and resource economics at Oregon State University. Janie started her career in Washington, D.C., working for Senator Larry Craig, then moved to the congressional office of then-Representative C.L. Butch Otter, serving as his deputy chief of staff. She and her husband, John, moved back to Idaho in 1996. Back in Idaho, she also worked part-time for Congressman Mike Simpson of the 2nd District. Janie served as the administrator of the Division of Financial Management in the State House. People refer to that as DFM. It's the governor's budget office, and she served in that position for 6 years in the Otter administration. Early last year, Governor Brad Little chose Janie to serve as director of the Idaho Department of Labor after he was inaugurated. Director Revere is proud to lead an agency with more than 450 employees who strive to make a difference in the lives of job seekers, employers, government officials, and Idaho citizens. She and her husband are parents of 12-year-old twins, and they reside in Meridian. And rounding out our panel with on-the-ground experience as an apprentice is Roderick Johnson. Roderick worked in the corporate world before he and his family moved to Idaho. He owned his own business and was the owner-operator in a dump truck transport business. He has a degree in computer management from Westwood Technical College in Upland, California. He moved to Idaho recently, where he has recently found more fulfilling work as a carpenter apprentice. He works under the direction of Michael Hill, who is a member of the National Association of Remodeling Industries and is one of our guests here today. He's also the owner of a design remodel business. And under that program, Roderick participates in the apprenticeship program. He will speak to us about his, I put a question mark after this because I don't think he's old enough, midlife career change, and how the skill set used in carpentry seems to really match his interests. He will talk also about what he's witnessed firsthand through this apprenticeship program, the importance of professionalism and a commitment to high standards. Roderick is married to a beautiful, wonderful wife, Annette, and who they, with their children, three children, live in Emmett. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Harold Neville, who will begin the discussion.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for allowing me to spend a few minutes describing CASA and what we do for students in the state of Idaho. 50 years ago, in 1969, seven school districts came together in what was really a very forward-thinking effort. They agreed that they didn't have the money to individually provide alternative education, meet all of their special education responsibilities, and meet all of the career and technical goals that they had for their students. So they actually got the law changed in Idaho, and you can still find it in statutes 33-315, 316, and 317, and those statutes allow the cooperation between school districts. So they formed a consortium and created the Canyon Hawaii School Service Agency. Seven school districts, Parma, Notice, Wilder, Homedale, Marcing, Middleton, and at that time the Canyon School District. That is now the Valley View School District. Canyon changed and became the Valley View School District. So they started it 50 years ago, long before charter schools or any of the other innovative schools that we're seeing nowadays. So I think it was very forward-thinking. And along the way, Middleton and Valley View dropped out of the consortium, so we're left with five, again, Parma, Notice, Wilder, Homedale, Marcing. And we are responsible for all of their special education. We have about 570 students right now that are in special education from those five school districts. We're responsible for the alternative school, about 140 students in the alternative school, and for all of the career and technical education. We provide career and technical education in two different formats. There's some programs remain at the school districts. All of those districts have their own ag program and their own business program. But then all of the high-dollar CTE programs, career and technical education programs, the students get on buses and come to our central location, which is in Wilder. We used to be scattered all over the different school districts providing services here and there, but in 2010 we opened a central facility in Wilder. It's called the CASA Regional Technology and Education Center. That's where our alternative school is, and that's where the high-dollar CTE shops are. We run two different sets of CTE programs, a three-hour set in the morning and a three-hour set in the afternoon. And as I said, we have about 220 students that come from the different school districts to take advantage of our programs. Auto, diesel, welding, construction, pre-engineering, EMT, nurse assistant, culinary. The way that we provide training for the students in an attempt to try to bridge this skills gap that we're coming up against is in four different ways. First of all, we work on skills. We build basic skills, and the students all work towards industry certification. These are industry-recognized credentials. So our welding students work towards AWS, which is American Welding Society certification, 3G, unlimited certification. 3 describes the position of the weld. That's a vertical weld. G means it's grooved, and unlimited means it's one-inch plate. So we have students who are coming out of our welding program who can vertically weld pieces of metal together, 1 inch thick, and repeat that weld to industry standards over and over again. It's a very exacting weld, and many college students, welding students, cannot meet that. But our students, that's their goal, and most of our students meet that goal. In the transportation areas, and in auto and diesel, they take ASE exams, the Automotive Service Excellence Exam. The CNA students, they get the state CNA exam. The EMT students, they earn EMT basic. So our students are getting these primary certifications through our training. They also get secondary certifications. All of our students have the opportunity to get CPR, OSHA 10-hour, forklift, crane. So these secondary skills sometimes are just as vital as the primary skills in getting the student a job. Besides the skill building, we work very hard on their work ethic. I will tell you that what I hear from industry is it's not the skills that lose the student the job, it's the fact that they don't show up for work on time, ready to work. That is, and I see many people's heads nodding, that is the big issue we have right now. So we don't teach that, we model it. They have to show up on time. We can't take their money away, obviously, but we can take points away if they're late. They have to take leadership roles. And so we model how we want them to be as employees in our shops, the teaching shops that we have every day, so that they come out of those shops with an understanding of what industry expects. We also, then, as they work their way up and then when they get into their senior year, we start looking for internships and apprenticeship opportunities. This is where we introduce the student to what it's really like in industry. Not all students will get an opportunity to participate in an internship or an apprenticeship. For one thing, if the student isn't ready, we're not going to send them out. I don't want to shoot myself in the foot by sending a student out to work who won't show up on time or doesn't show up sober, because that industry partner is going to say, no, thank you. So, but the students that are ready, and by ready I mean they've passed their primary certification and they've worked their way up through the secondary certifications and they've shown a strong work ethic, we will enter into a training contract with industry partners and we'll put the student on an apprenticeship or an internship, and they'll go out to the industry partner to extend their learning. I do not want to see them out there pushing a broom. I want them to learn something more that they can't learn in our shop. And sometimes what they learn is, this isn't what I want. When we send our welders out, remember, we have them for 3 hours, and they weld for 3 hours. Well, when they go out to industry, they weld for 8 hours. And sometimes they come back and say, I can't stand there and weld for 8 hours. It's driving me crazy. Okay, you've learned something. That's not what you want to do. Look for a fabrication job where you're moving around more or something like that. So that's, and the students that are ready, and they've, and we only about half of our students do this, but the ones that are ready will go out usually their second semester of their senior year, and they'll spend the time that they would have been with us in an internship or an apprenticeship program with the industry. The last thing that we do is we also run a program of adult education to enhance the training of any employee, but primarily try to stay in contact with our students that are out there working, so that if they need to enhance their skills, they have a place to come back and do that. Two big areas where we enhance training are in welding and in nursing. The area out there where, you know, if you're familiar with Wilder in the very far west of the Treasure Valley, there's a lot of agribusiness, but there are also manufacturing, and then there's some healthcare industry, and they have a very hard time getting workers. So we provide skills building for workers who need to increase their skills. Our number one that we do is in the welding area, we certify food grade welders. So if you're familiar with welding, that means that they're welding stainless steel, and there can be no imperfections because food product is moving down the lines. The dairy industry and the food producers send us their black iron welders, and we turn them into food grade welders through training that we do in the evening. And we have a very successful program with that. The other is with nurse assistants. We take nurse assistants students and turn them into certified nurse assistant, which means that they can move up in pay at the nursing homes and the long-term care facilities. So those four areas are how we train and retrain the workforce. A lot of people like to know when I talk to them, how much of this do we do online? None. It is all hands-on. Our students are by far primarily hands-on learners. And you know, every student needs to be taught to how they learn, and there probably are opportunities for some students who can learn online. But for these trade areas, we focus hands-on learning. That's what we're doing. So some more things to think about in the as we talk about the gap, the skills gap. It used to be that students would come out of high school and their goal was to go right to a four-year college and then on to work. For a while, we saw students that started realizing just how much that four-year college was going to cost, and they would come out of high school and they'd go to a two-year college and knock out some of the preliminary courses and stuff. Then they'd go to the four-year college, and then they'd go on to work. Now we're seeing more and more of our students who come out of high school and go right to work. And while they're at work and working their way up in their trade area, then they go to college as they need to. And they'll go to either a two- or a four-year school, whichever one fits their schedule. So they'll pay as they go. Industry doesn't care whether they've come out of college or not. What industry wants to know is, do they have the prerequisite skills? Because industry is going to test them and retrain them, every single student. That's what industry has to do to make sure that their worker is going to be able to succeed in their industry. And it doesn't make any difference if a student comes out of our program, a high school program, or if they come out of a college program. They're still going to be tested, and then they're going to go into that industry-specific training program. So what is the difference between a high school graduate that comes out of our program, goes to apprenticeship, gets a job with industry, and then gets tested and retrained, or a college student who comes out and has even longer training, but then goes to industry and gets tested and gets retrained? The difference is the debt. And a lot of families out there are terrified of college debt. So that's something that we need to be aware of. There are people making choices, students making choices with their families, not to go to college because they don't want that massive debt. And we offer them an opportunity to get a job without that. We have to figure out how to remove barriers, no matter who is doing the training. And when you see industry promoting internships and apprenticeships, where they're saying, we will take students and we'll train them, you need to ask the question, is there something wrong with the normal training pipeline? Because industry wouldn't do that, wouldn't spend that money if they didn't have to. So what's happening now with these the growth in the internship and apprenticeship programs is industry is telling us there's a mismatch. The workers are coming out without the training we need. We're willing to take them on and train them, but I think we ought to step back and say, are we training our workers as they need to be trained so that they can succeed in these industries? And we have a very close working relationship with our industry partners so that we always listen to them and try to make sure that how we're training our students is going to meet industry's needs. So that's a little bit about CASA. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And I think we're on to Jane.
Well, thank you for having me here today and to have the opportunity to share a little with you all about some of the work that the Department of Labor is doing to help close that skills gap that Dr. Neville discussed. The Department of Labor is working to expand apprenticeship opportunities across the state. For those of you that don't know, a registered apprenticeship is a combination of on-the-job learning and related technical instruction under the supervision of an experienced mentor or trade professional in which workers learn the practical and theoretical aspects of a highly skilled occupation while earning money. The Department of Labor is working to expand apprenticeship opportunities in traditional industries like construction, as well as non-traditional industries such as cybersecurity, healthcare, technology, advanced manufacturing, and financial services. Our focus over the next 3 years is to build a pipeline of skilled workforce by placing almost 500 career seekers into apprenticeship opportunities. Labor is uniquely suited to do this since we're connected to career seekers, employers, and educators, and have programs and services to provide both career seekers and employers with registered apprenticeship programs. The Department of Labor has three full-time registered apprenticeship consultants. Gina Robinson here in the crowd is our Boise person, and she is running the whole program for us across the state. We also have an individual in North Idaho and Eastern Idaho. These folks will work to help guide and assist employers in planning and in the planning and approval process of creating a registered apprenticeship program and offer technical assistance to sponsors and mentors. We're also helping employers recruit apprentices by raising awareness of apprenticeship opportunities. We can also offer some cost reimbursements to career seekers and employers to offset some of the additional costs of the instruction. I also want to share a little about the Idaho Job Corps program. It's another program we have at the Department of Labor. It's a brand new program. Idaho is the first state to operate a Job Corps site. Labor assumed control of the Nampa Centennial site in July and has been working with community colleges to develop a new model that will be rolled out around the state over the next year. There was some talk that the Centennial site has been shut down. I just want to make sure everyone knows that it is up and running. It will be different, but we will still have a Job Corps site here in the state. The Idaho Job Corps is a three-year demonstration project offering income-eligible youth ages 16 to 24 training and support to connect them to in-demand jobs in Idaho. The program provides a wide variety of services to remove barriers that get in the way of student success, such as healthcare, dental services, meals, counseling, and wellness and life skills training. Students will obtain their high school diploma or GED and will be connected with volunteer and leadership opportunities in the community. After identifying a career, they will embark on the appropriate educational pathway through the community college to obtain meaningful credentials that will result in a quality job at a livable wage. We are in the first year of the grant, and we will have 100 non-residential students in the partnership with CW or the College of Western Idaho. Early next year, we will start the residential program, and we will have 50 residential students on the Job Corps site, and they will receive training from the College of Western Idaho. By June of next year, we'll expand the program to the other community colleges across the state, and we'll have 50 non-residential students at each of the other community colleges, North Idaho College, College of Southern Idaho, and College of Eastern Idaho. I'm excited to report that our first cohort of 20 students has started. These students are interested in computer science, medical, electrical, automotive, and business administration and drafting. We'll be enrolling additional students in December and every month thereafter. We're looking for businesses willing to allow our students to job shadow or that have an apprenticeship or internship program and are looking for participants. If you know of a business or you're interested in participating with Job Corps, please let Tina Polishuk, our program manager, know. At the Department of Labor, we're always looking at how we can better provide services to Idahoans in a way that can withstand constant changes in funding at the federal level and still be responsive to real community needs. Recently, we unveiled a new model of delivering services, and we will be in more places than ever before throughout the state. We're investing in people, not buildings. The new model retains all current personnel and allows them to provide the same services to businesses and job seekers and unemployment insurance claimants. We are working with community partners such as libraries, state agencies, city, counties, and not-for-profit entities, as well as others, to provide meeting space. Staff will have well-advertised office hours and provide access for unemployment insurance filers and job seekers, as well as appointment times for interview, casework, and outreach. We're providing all the same level of service and performing the same job, but we're finding innovative ways to bring our services directly to our customers. We've transitioned 14 local offices into remote service delivery that provides a department presence in almost 50 communities. Instead of waiting for our customers to travel to our local offices, we're going to be going to them. A complete list of our locations can be found on our website. Once you connect with our staff, you will see that we provide a variety of services geared to help job seekers attain sustainable employment as quickly as possible, such as computer access for looking and applying for jobs and for filing unemployment claims. Job search tips, resume assistance, interest and aptitude assessments, career pathway information, and labor market information are some of the other things that our staff provide. Through our Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act grant, or WIOA, we also offer more in-depth services to those who qualify based on income and eligibility guidelines. These services include providing financial assistance related to job search and employability, such as assistance with gas to and from job search, work, or training, interview-appropriate clothing, job or industry-specific clothing or tools, or training assistance, tuition, and books. These services are geared toward the individual job seeker, allowing the participant to use and build upon his or her existing skills and to find the quickest way towards sustainable wages. Sue also asked me to explain the difference between labor and the Workforce Development Council. About 2 years ago, the Workforce Development Council was still part of the Department of Labor. It was decided to separate the two, and now the Workforce Development Council is a standalone agency. They are responsible for administering the Workforce Development Training Fund, which is a fund that businesses pay into through their unemployment insurance tax. And those dollars can be used to retrain and help deal with these pipeline issues that we're talking about. We work closely with the Workforce Development Council, but it is a separate entity, and they're no longer part of the Department of Labor. So with that, if you all have any questions, I would be, well, I guess first we'll let Roderick speak, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I appreciate the time for being invited to be on this level. My name is Roderick Johnson, as I already stated. I am married to a beautiful, wonderful wife and have three children, as already stated, and they are intelligent. I have worked in the corporate world on my own as an owner-operator of a dump truck transport. That was a type of business that took asphalt from the plant to whatever road they was working on, and then we took up the old road and took it back to the plant, and they recycled the material. So that way, we're saving the planet. However, I found my most fulfillment in the workplace working as a carpenter apprentice. The skill set used in carpentry best matches my interests. I work under the direction of Michael Hill, where I am a witness firsthand to the importance of professionalism, a committed, high standard, ethical business practices. I enjoy weekly NORI classes and am excited about learning additional carpentry skills. These classes that NORI give, we have senior tradesmen come in and they talk to us about how, like tools, what kind of tools we need, starting with the old tools to the new tools, the safety. We also get OSHA training, the 10-hour OSHA training, so we can be safe on the job. Then we learned, be exposed to truss, building plans, all the type of things that goes on in residential building we are being exposed to during the NORI meetings. I think that mastering carpentry is extremely valuable and will pass on what I have learned to my children so they will have skills and trade also. As Dr. Harold Neville mentioned, passing these skills on is very important. I'm going to use the term upline, except there's no money involved. Once I learn my skills, I'm going to pass it on. And then my ultimate plan for my children is to not come out with a college debt. So they'll learn this skill as carpentry, and then in the summertime they'll work. And then when school starts in the fall, they go in the fall, so that way they can pay their own way. Words cannot express my gratitude to be able to participate in the apprentice program with NORI and the Department Idaho Department of Labor. I am looking forward to continue working and thriving as a carpenter apprentice. Thank you.
As you could see, the questions were flowing in very quickly, and there's some really interesting ones. Janie, I'm going to start with one to you because this was in the news recently, or last summer, I think. Could you talk a little bit about the closures of some of the physical offices in Idaho and how you're reaching out to rural areas?
Sure. So as I said, we have developed a new model of delivering services. Rather than having our bricks and mortar office and waiting for people to come to us, we did close down 14 of our offices. And now we partner with different entities in the community, such as libraries, the city hall, nonprofit agencies. And they are providing us meeting space, and our staff now travels from community to community and provides the services that we used to provide in one set location in these communities about the state. And so instead of just being in 16 communities, we're now in almost 50 communities across the state, still providing the same services, still having the same opportunities for people to interact with our staff. We're just doing it in a little bit different way. In the past, we had computer access that people would come and use to search for jobs or to file their unemployment insurance. We know that's important because connectivity can be a problem in some of our rural areas. So we continue to have that computer access. All of these remote teams will have their own computer plus computers for the customer that comes in and needs them. And so we're trying to be innovative in the way we're delivering our services and be in more places than ever before.
Great, thank you. And this question is probably for you, Harold. Do you feel, I'm going to combine two questions. One of the questioners reflects on or says a rural Idaho high school offered a welding class, then found it too expensive to run, so they started to charge a fee. That was found to not be legal because of being in the public school. So it relates to this other question. Do you feel career technical opportunities for K through 12 students, are they equal around the state, or are there haves and have-nots when it comes to CTE? And do you have suggestions for other areas? Because it sounds like you have quite a good model involving 7 school districts in Canyon and Owyhee County.
charging fees is illegal, and we don't charge anything other than we do have a list of supplies that students might have to buy to be safe in the shop, but they're going to own that. So if you're going to work in our shops, you're going to have safety shoes. And the student is expected to buy that. Now, right in the manual that says they're going to have to buy those safety shoes and then they're going to own them, it does say that if you can't afford them, please let us know, because we have sponsors and industry partners who will help us buy those for the students. So no student should ever be turned away. The question about if there are the haves and the have-nots in CTE, that is absolutely true. CTE is not that different than regular education, and we all know that if you live in a zip code that has the ability to pass levies and has a pretty solid tax base, then you have the funds available to provide the education, whatever type of education it is. On the other hand, if you live in a very rural area and folks are not too interested in passing levies, and you just don't have the property tax base out there, then all of your educational programs are going to be lacking, and that includes career and technical education. What has happened In the state of Idaho, there are 17 career and technical schools. So CASA is the CT side of CASA is a career and technical school, and we are not the only one. There are 16 others, and around Idaho, school districts have combined to offer CTE services. That is a viable option for more districts. The problem becomes transportation, so that they have to be close enough together to say, okay, we'll ship our students over to you because you're going to have the shop, but having a student on a bus for an hour to get someplace to take a class is not going to work either. So there are some places that are out there pretty remote, and they probably aren't going to be able to partner with anybody. And the solution there, I think, is, as in all areas of education, we've got to level the playing field, we've got to get more money into education, and those rural schools need to be able to offer just as quality a program as any other school. If they can't combine, they need to be able to offer it by themselves.
Okay, and I have a follow-up question, and that has to do with whether school districts are really doing an adequate job of advertising CTE programs as a platform to higher education, that is either perhaps going to 2 or a 4-year college program as a way to provide the skills needed and at the same time help fund higher education. Would you, and anyone else who'd like to address
well,
that?
I'll start. I'm sure that all of us have opinions on this. The cost of college is daunting to many families out there, and a viable alternative is to work your way through. And it does mean that you're going to finish over a longer period of time, but if you can graduate, even if it's in 6 years instead of 4, and you don't have the debt, it's worth it. Believe me, it is the debt that our students and families are seeing nowadays is so staggering that it scares people off. Well, you don't have to be scared off. You just have to get a job and work your way through college, and it will take a little bit longer, and you do have to give up some evenings and some weekends, but I did it. I didn't get my PhD until I was 54, and that I worked for I never spent time on an actual college campus. I would just show up and take classes and then leave. It's a good thing because I'd probably drink too much if I had been. but that is a viable pathway, and I think it is an answer. It may not be the only answer, but it's an answer to having less debt. And I think the other panel probably thinks it too.
Janie would like to address that.
So I think as a college graduate, I think a college degree is very important, but it's not for everyone. There are a variety of pathways people can have to get an additional accreditation or higher learning. Everyone doesn't have to have a college degree, but to get a good job, you generally have to have some sort of accreditation that's transferable. And some of these alternative pathways are very useful and a better fit for many of our students. It's one of the nice things about America. You have a lot of opportunities on how you can get where you need to be.
Thank you. And let me remind our radio audience that you're listening to City Club of Boise's Forum on Workforce Development. And our three panelists are Dr. Harold Neville, who is with the CASA program in Cannon and Hawaii programs, counties, and Roderick Johnson, who is in an apprenticeship program, and Janie Revere, who is the director of the Department of Labor. Now, I've got two related questions, and any of you are, it's not directed to anybody in particular. Do you think that lowering college tuition or even free college tuition would improve or make worse the skills gap? And a related question is, do apprenticeships ever help pay tuition? Anybody want to take that first? Roderick, go ahead.
When you learn carpentry, whether it's drywalling or framing, I'm speaking more to the younger group out here. When you learn those skills, and then you get ready to go to college. Say, for instance, someone wants to add a room to their house, you would know how to do it. And it will put some good money in your pocket. So being a carpenter will help you lower your own school bill by not coming out with debt.
Great. A thought.
And go ahead, Harold.
So the question, the part of the question was about should tuition be lowered? Yes, tuition should be lower. It's too expensive for too many students. But the way that community colleges especially are getting, money through the credits, I don't know how we're going to get away from it unless we can increase the amount of the training that's going to come from the workforce development area, where it's not tied to credits, it's tied to what Janie talked about, certifications. Work towards certifications, work towards specific learning goals, and just pay for that portion instead of having to get the buy-in for the entire degree. I think that probably is one way that we could get the same result, which is certified and qualified workers, but for less money.
Great. Janie, do you want to address that? Okay. This, again, is a two-part question, and I'm trying to get the real serious question. Well, they're all serious questions, but these are very complex questions. This is from a student asking what your thoughts are on minimum wage and the impact it has on families, especially single parents or single-income households. And that relates to another question, and this one was directed especially to Janie. Idaho has a very low rate of unemployment, as I pointed out in the introductory remarks. We also have one of the lowest per capita income levels. How can the state help to address the low incomes? So that's a two-part question, and we'll let Janie take it first, and then if either of the other of you want to weigh in, please do.
So Idaho does match the minimum wage to the federal minimum wage. There's been a lot of discussion about whether that's appropriate. So we want to consider raising it, as some of our neighboring states have. And I will leave that discussion up to the legislators. It's a very politically charged issue, and I don't have an opinion. I just administer the program. We do know that few people in the state are actually making minimum wage. In order to hire someone, by and large, you have to pay more in order to get that skilled employee. And so while there are some individuals still making minimum wage, it's not very many. And I guess I'll leave it at that for the minimum wage discussion. When it comes to the wages in Idaho, the Department of Labor, we have a lot of data, and we are constantly working with businesses that are having a hard time recruiting, and sharing with them at their request labor market information, what they need to pay to have a competitive salary in order to attract workers. And that's the role that we're trying to fulfill. I think the larger issue on mandating salaries, like I said before, I think would be left up to the politicians in the Capitol. And so that's about all I have.
Wilder is only about 7 miles from the Oregon border. And if you go straight west, you can go straight west, by the way, from Wilder, you wind up on a little bridge that takes you over to Adrian, Oregon, which all of the people that are driving from Boise and Cannon County to go over to the distributors over there, that's how they come back, so that they don't get picked up. They drive right by us. We see them all the time. But the other thing that happens to us is we lose employees to Oregon because Oregon has a higher minimum wage. I would support a much higher minimum wage in the state of Idaho.
Okay. There has been talk about college debt and getting a job. Can you clarify the difference between getting a job and whether that requires a person to really look at in-demand industry?
Are you asking anybody?
Yeah, anybody. Do you want to start, Harold? Or Janie, do you want to start? Whichever one.
So the Department of Labor, like I said, we have a lot of data, a lot of information, and so we work to identify the in-demand jobs. We have been working with the Board of Education to try and make it easier for students to access that information. We have lists of the jobs that are most available by region that pay the highest and the accreditation that is necessary to receive those jobs. And so the information is out there. I think that it is important that students look at that when deciding what they want to major in, what industry they want to get involved in. It's pretty tragic when a kid spends 4 years in college and comes out with a degree that they can't do very much with and all of the debt burden. I think it's real important that we have a strong counseling component in our education to help advise students on what career opportunities are, and that's not just college. I think it also needs to look at some of the apprenticeships and other opportunities that we've been talking about, just to give more of a well-rounded picture.
Great. We've had several questions related to adults. Are there programs? You mentioned, Harold, in your program in the two fields, welding and nursing. Are there programs generally for adults who are already working seeking a career change? And a related question has to do with the downsizing of some of our major tech firms that have been big employers here, HP and Micron in particular. What programs might be available for experienced employees who have 20 to 30 years of experience? And are there trends that would help them bridge employment until they reach 65?
I'll just say quickly that the most important thing to learn is how to learn, because you're going to have to change your job. The very few jobs are staying the same over long periods of time. So make sure you know how to learn and that you have a good work ethic. The two programs that I mentioned that we do for adults, they happen to be our premier programs, but we offer adult training, all sorts of different adult training. So do the community colleges through their workforce development, and I would bet Janie knows a lot more about the workforce development than I do.
Janie?
So as Dr. Neville said, the community colleges do have a lot of training programs. We can... for individuals that meet the eligibility requirements, we can help offset some of the costs if they need to enroll in those programs so that they can have training opportunities if their field of study goes away, that we can help train to a new job or a career. We at the Department of Labor don't run the programs outside of Job Corps. The colleges and universities do all of that.
Great. And there was one question. I'll just mention it. I don't think anybody needs to respond, but a questioner asked, has there been consideration given to opening Job Corps opportunities for older workers? That then that might be something for the future. Janie,
so the Job Corps is it's the age range is set by federal statute. So no, we cannot go above 24.
Okay, all right. So that's something that would require a change in federal law. And I do have a question for Rod. In addition to carpentry, which you're learning and working in, are you learning other trades and project management skills in your apprenticeship?
Oh, yes. I work with Mike Hill, Design CCH, Design Remodel. I manage the different tradesmen coming in. So you have a 12-week schedule to get this project done. Someone has to coordinate when one trade is going to finish so the next one can start, and then getting materials on the job site so they can use, or whatever the case may be. So, yes, I am being a manager too.
Great. Thank you very much. We are reaching our time limit, and I'm going to close with a question. I'm sorry that I was not able to get to all the questions. There are some very good ones, and usually our speakers can remain behind for a few minutes. So if your questions didn't get answered, feel free to come up if it was directed to a specific person. For our last question, I would like to ask each of our panelists, what do you think is the more salient factor in companies or industries' decision whether or not to locate in Idaho? And the three choices listed, and if you feel there's a fourth one that's more important, a trained workforce, the quality of life, or corporate tax policy? Those are the three listed. You're not limited to answering on those. Rod, do you want to start? Because you can say why you decided to relocate here.
It was more of a two-factor. The politics from where I came from, I will not mention, didn't really agree with me. So this place, Idaho, has a more of a, the way it's governed, the way it's run, the openness, the farms, the bread barns, all that appeals to me. And then the forestry, rivers, homeschooling, that really appeal to my family and I. So we decided to come here. It was the best choice. And if I may mention, Idaho is one of the last greatest holdouts, so stay with Idaho.
Janie.
I think it depends on the business and the industry and what their factors are, depending on which industry it is. Any one of the top three could be the first.
Okay, and Harold?
In the trades areas, the folks that I talk to, it's a skilled workforce by far.
Okay. And I would like to end this forum with, I'm going to not pose it as a question, but it was really a suggestion from one of our audience members. And because we have representatives here from both public schools and from higher education, this person, and this is a student, I believe, in high school, CTE courses are primarily worked towards achieving competencies. Would integrating this style of learning into higher education lower tuition costs and perhaps the time spent in higher education? So I would just pose that as a rhetorical question that we might all take away from this. And I would like to thank our panelists very much for what they've offered to us today. And I know we've also all gained insights. And we have a small thank you for each of you, a very famous City Club mug that, if you're not a coffee drinker, it holds pencils, pens, or drafting equipment in an excellent manner. Thank you. Would you join me in thanking our audience?
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club Forum is on Thursday, December 5th, and will cover cybersecurity and the Fourth Industrial Revolution, how technology is changing the way we live, work, and relate to one another. Learn more about that forum at cityclubofboise.org and connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.